Yeah, the fact that I've been walking with Jesus now for about 27 years, 27 and a half years to be exact, and spent many, many, many hours in Bible study. But prophecy is one area of the Scriptures that I have purposely neglected. And I have to say to you that I, up until I began this study, knew less about the subject than I did about any other subject in the Bible. As a matter of fact, it was kind of an embarrassment to me. I knew so little about it. And people would ask me, you know, what I was in terms of my religious or spiritual convictions, and I would tell them I was a Reformed Dispensational Baptist. And I figured that with a name like that, I could cover just about everything. And those of you who are familiar with theology at all know that in the Reformed faith, they have an acrostic for their faith, and the word is TULIP. And TULIP stands for T, total depravity, U, unconditional election, L, limited atonement, I, irresistible grace, and P, perseverance of the saints. And so a buddy and I got together one time, and we decided that we would form in our new denomination of the Reformed Dispensational Baptists. And by the way, there are really only two members in it, that buddy and I, and so it's a very small and exclusive denomination. But we selected for our acrostic the word pansy, rather than TULIP. And the PANSY stands for P, Panmillennialism, which is really this study of theology. And we're panmillennialists in the sense that we felt that everything's going to pan out all right. And the A stands for allegorical demythologizing, which simply means that we can make the Bible say anything we want it to say. And N stands for neo-ecumenism, which means that we believe in unity on our terms. And S stands for superlapsarianism, which has to do with the order of events in the mind of God before creation, which forms the archstone of our theology. It's the most important thing to us. And then Y stands for Yom Kippur, which is our doctrine of the atonement and the date of our annual meeting. So pansy is our theology. And this really was kind of a smokescreen on my part, really, to cover up the embarrassment that I had over the fact that I had never really spent any time studying prophecy. And I guess one of the reasons why I avoided it is because it was so controversial. And I had read a number of books on the subject, but the books that I had read on the subject, I discovered that they approached it topically. And they would say, now, the first thing that's going to take place is this, and then they take a verse here, and then quote it, and a verse here, and a quote it, and a verse here, and quote it. And I would listen to read those verses, and I'd say, yeah, I understand this, but I really wonder whether that's what the verse means in the context. You know, are they just kind of pulling them out? And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to approach my study of prophecy from the perspective of taking it a book at a time. And so this is what I have done. And what we're going to do is we're going to take some of the major books in the Bible. Now, we're not going to cover all of the books that deal with prophecy. But it seemed to me that there were four major sections in the Bible that dealt with prophecy. And the four we're going to cover fairly thoroughly in the time that we're together is the book of Zechariah, Daniel, and then in the New Testament, Matthew 24 and 25, where the disciples take Jesus aside and say, now, when is the end going to take place? And Jesus says, well, sit down, gentlemen, and I'll explain it to you. And he takes two chapters and talks about it. And then, of course, the book of Revelation. So that's really going to be our approach. We're going to talk about Zechariah and Daniel in the Old Testament, and Matthew 24 and 25, and the book of Revelation in the New Testament. Now, there are other passages that are germane to the subject of prophecy. For example, you have the book of Ezekiel, particularly the last section of Ezekiel. But a lot of that in the book of Amos and some of the chapters out of Isaiah and so forth are really redundant. They're covered rather thoroughly in the four sections that we're going to be covering, so that I feel that we can catch a biblical and accurate understanding of it in the passages that we'll be looking at. And then we'll look very briefly also at one other passage, and that's Romans 9, 10, and 11, where Paul talks about the future for Israel. Now, as I was thinking about this, it seemed to me that there's a number of reasons why the average person stays away from prophecy. And what I want to do is discuss those with you. One of the reasons why I, for one, and a lot of people like me, stay away from the subject of prophecy is that there's a preoccupation in prophecy with the crown rather than the cross. And there's a world going to hell on a roller coaster, and there are very, very few people who care. And it seems to me that we ought to be preoccupied with the proclamation of the cross than try to figure out what the crown's going to be like. And that's one of the reasons why people stay away from it. And by the way, I'll mention to you some of the things that I have written out, some of the overlays I've got written out. In this series or sequence, I've got written out for you, and I've got them up here, and if you want them, you're welcome to have them. And then another reason why people stay away from prophecy is people have been saying that we've lived in the last days for centuries, and everybody seems to be wrong. And every time you turn around, somebody says, well, boy, we're really living in the last days. And you read the history books, they've been thinking we've been in the last days for umpteen hundreds of years. Another reason is that the passages in the Bible deal with visions and strange creatures that talk about horses with heads on them and wings and all kinds of other kooky things, and it tends to make us a little bit nervous. And when we read that, we think to ourselves, well, you know, I wonder if that passage or those portions are really all that reliable. Then a fourth reason why people have a tendency to stay away from prophecy is that many in the past have predicted the return of Christ, and they sell all that they've got, go to the top of some mountain to wait for him, only to return with kind of egg on their faces. And they say, well, I guess we misjudged that. And so most of us don't want to be associated with kooks like that. And we say to ourselves, well, I'd rather be a pan-millennialist than try to put some kind of date to the thing and find that I'm all wet and all wrong. Then a fifth reason why people stay away from prophecy is that those who emphasize prophecy appear to be looking for an escape from their problems. And most of us are pragmatic doers who would rather face our problems or rather run from them. And a lot of people who talk about the end times and the coming of the Lord, you know, are looking for an escape hatch. They're saying, boy, let's get out of this thing. And rather than willing to face the difficulties and situations of life. And then finally, one other reason is it's a controversial subject. Now, it's easy for most of us to understand the difference between those who believe the Bible and those who don't believe the Bible. But many people believe the Bible to be the inerrant, infallible, inspired Word of God and yet differ regarding prophecy. Some are premillennialists, some are postmillennialists, some are amillennialists, some are promillennialists, you know, the promillennialist. The pro-millennialist says, I don't understand it, but I'm for it. And the pan-millennialist, which is what I used to be, simply says, well, I don't understand it either, but it's going to pan out all right. And then, of course, there's the premillennialist, which says that the millennium comes after Jesus brings the church out and before he sets up his, the new heaven and the new earth. And then the postmillennialist says that, well, the millennium is ushered in by things getting better and better. It's the philosophy of yesteryear, which says, in every way, every day, things are getting better and better. And then, of course, the amillennialist, which says that, well, the millennium is not a literal period of time, but it's figurative for the time in which we're now living today, the day of the church. And so there's all these different arguments and controversies regarding it, and nobody really understands much about it. Now, if this is true, if there are so many differences regarding the view of the end times, then the question we have to ask ourselves is, why study the subject? If it is controversial, then why don't we leave it alone? that maybe I practiced the better part of wisdom in spending the first 27 and a half years of my life walking with Jesus avoiding the subject. Maybe all of us should avoid it. Kind of major on the cross, forget the crown, and press air of the night. Why study prophecy? And I'd like to suggest to you that there are three major reasons why we ought to be studying the subject of prophecy. There is some pragmatic value to it. Now, the three reasons that I give are going to be, again, up here in this sheet right here. And you can pick those up afterwards if you'd like. But I'd like you to... I reproduced this right here. The three reasons I have listed here is, number one, it is in the Bible. Somebody look up Acts 20, verse 27. I hope there's enough light in this room so that we can read our Bibles. Somebody look up Acts 20, verse 27 and read it for us.
Then he said to Thomas, reach here your finger and see my hands.
No, that's not Acts, that's John.
Well, you're right. Put your arrow here. 2017.
Acts 20, 27.
That's pretty close.
This next door.
There we go, yeah. For I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole purpose of God.
Okay. Or as another translation says, I didn't shrink from declaring to you the whole counsel of God. When Paul ministered to the Ephesians, he says, I ministered to you the whole counsel of God. Now, it seems to me that if there are any portions of God's counsel that we're ignorant of, we ought to move toward rather than away from those portions. And that's really one of the reasons why I decided that I would give the better part of a year to the study of prophecy. Because it's in the Bible. And because we should understand and know the whole counsel of God. And because the Bible says a great deal about prophecy. And because a lot of the Bible deals with prophecy, it's important to God. And if it's important to God, it ought to be important to us. Now, the second reason why is that it's an important link in understanding the priesthood of the believer. Now, what I want to do is discuss with you for a few moments this whole concept of the priesthood of the believer. In order to do that, let me take you historically back a little bit. In the book of Genesis, we find in the beginning of the book of Genesis, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And then they're expelled from the Garden of Eden because of sin. That all takes place in the first three chapters. And in chapter 4, there's a controversy that exists between Cain and Abel. And the controversy deals with sacrifice. And Abel offered unto God an animal, and Cain offered unto God the fruit of the earth, the produce of the earth, grain and fruits and things like this. And Abel's sacrifice was accepted to God, and Cain's was rejected. And so Cain got his nose bent out of joint, and he went off and pouted a little bit, and God pursued him. He says, I don't know why you're all ticked off over this whole thing. He said, you know the problem. Offer the right kind of sacrifice, and I'll accept it. The problem's not with me, the problem's not with your brother, the problem's with you. Well, Cain didn't take too kindly to that, and so he killed his brother Abel. And that was, of course, the first murder. But the thing I want you to notice is that the first murder in the Bible centered around the offering of sacrifice. And the thing I want you to notice about the sacrifice is that every individual was responsible for offering his own sacrifice. Cain offered his, Abel offered his, Adam offered his. And this is the story of the book of Genesis. Each individual offers his own sacrifice wherever he is. And so Abraham offers his. If he's in Bethel, that's where he offers it. If he's Ai, he offers it there. If he's Peniel, he offers it there. If he's down at Hebron, he offers it there. Same with Jacob. Same with Noah. All of these men, their families, they offered their sacrifices. In other words, everybody functioned in the role of being his own priest. Now, this happened from the book of Genesis for centuries and centuries and centuries, and we don't know how many, maybe millenniums, on up until the book of Exodus and Mount Sinai. Now, at Mount Sinai, you remember Israel is on their way out of the land of slavery into the land of promise. And there at Mount Sinai, God spends some time with them, a little over a year, and he welds them together as a nation. And he gives to them the law, and he establishes with the law the priesthood. And what he did was he took the priesthood out of the hands of the ordinary believer, and he put it into the hands of the professional. And he said, the tribe of Levi will represent me in the office of the priesthood, but not just the tribe of Levi, only the house of Aaron of the tribe of Levi will be actually able to offer the sacrifices. Now, that stuck right in Israel's throat. They didn't really go down all that well. They complained and griped a little bit about that. And, of course, you remember, there in the book of Numbers, a group of them got together with Dathan, Korah, and Abiram, and they came to Moses and they said, we don't like your new idea of the priesthood of the professional. We like the priesthood of the individual, the believer. And Moses said, well, that wasn't my idea, that was God's. And they said, well, you take too much on yourself. We can get together with God by ourselves. We don't need you. And Moses, being the meekest man on the face of the earth, said, well, why don't we talk it over with God and see what God says? And so God gets together with him, and he says, well, let me show you what I think of that idea. So he opens up the earth, and Dathan, Korah, and Abiram, and all that pertains to them drops in, and God closes the earth. And then he consumes with fire the 120 leaders of Israel that were with him and says, are there any other questions? And the people got kind of mad. They got ticked off at Moses. And they said, Moses, you dirty rat, you sick God on us. And God says, well, let me show you what I think of that idea. 14,000 people died of the plague. And God said, any other questions? And the children of Israel said, no, we really think we've got your point. But that wasn't the end of it. There were still some more grumblings. And so the next chapter, God says, okay, we're going to settle it once for all. Have the 12 tribes elect a leader, and have each leader come and bring their walking stick, or their staff. And we'll take the, and mark your name on the staff, we'll take the 12 staffs, and we'll put them in the tabernacle. And the next morning, they came in, and one of the staffs, one of the 12, budded, started to grow. And that was the staff of Levi. So that God showed to them, once for all, the priesthood of the professional. Now, the priesthood of the professional was the way that God did it, for 1,500 years, the time from Moses to Jesus Christ. Then when Jesus Christ came in and performed his sacrifice on the cross, at the moment of his death, what happened to the temple? The veil was rent, wasn't it? From top to bottom, signifying that all of us now have access into the presence of the living God. And what he did there was, he said, we're now reverting back to the priesthood of the believer. So from Genesis 3, for I don't know how many thousands of years, until Moses, you had the priesthood of the believer. For 1,500 years, you had the priesthood of the professional. And then from Jesus Christ on, until he comes again, you've got the priesthood of the believer. And that simply means that every one of us have both the right and the responsibility to function in the capacity as God's priest. This was the dynamic of the New Testament church. Everybody understood their role of representing Jesus Christ in the context of their community, their family, the marketplace, wherever they were. And they went out doing it. But about 150 A.D., things began to change. They began to evolve. And they moved from the priesthood of the believer to the priesthood of the professional. Now, it didn't happen overnight. It happened very slowly and gradually. So that the communion table became an altar. Communion became a sacrifice. The pastor was called a priest. He began to dress like a priest. People were discouraged from going before God and confessing their sins on their own, but they had to come through the professional to do it. Instead of everybody confessing their sins and praying before God, the professional now in the church turned his back on the people and prayed thusly, representing the people before God as though the people could not represent themselves. Now, how did that happen? How did that happen? I'd like to suggest to you tonight that the reason that took place, how that happened, was that in the early church, there was a clear distinction in the mind of the people between the church and the promises of God to Israel. Now remember, in the early church, in the New Testament church, most of the believers were what nationality? Jews, weren't they? As you read your New Testament, you find that most of those letters in the New Testament were written to Jews, trying to encourage Jews to accept us Gentiles. Now, it's just turned around. The church is predominantly Gentile, not Jewish. And when that happened, when that began to take place as the church evolved, what it did was it went into the Old Testament and it said all of the promises that God made to Israel are over. And that all those promises now belong to the church. And they said that there's no difference between Israel and the church. The church is Israel, and Israel is the church. And when they did that, they embraced all of the form of Israel as well. When they began to embrace the promises given to Israel, they began to embrace the practices of Israel as well. And so they began to think Old Testament in terms of the ministry. Does that make sense? And so they thought Levitical. They thought priesthood. They thought professional priest. They thought, let's dress like them. Let's call ourselves that. Let's revert back to that. Because we're now functioning in the capacity of Israel in the Old Testament. And so it seems to me that one of the reasons why we should study prophecy is to understand the role that God has assigned to each of us in functioning as a priest for Him in the context of our family, our community, our business, our vocation, the calling of God for our lives. In the Old Testament, if you wanted a minister, you went through the professional. In the New Testament, you are the priest. 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, is spiritual, not secular. And I belong to First Presbyterian Church, and John Stevens is our pastor, and that's his pulpit. And just as First Presbyterian Church is John Stevens' pulpit, so also Perkins Motors is your pulpit. Or Commercial Equity is your pulpit. Or Dentistry is your pulpit. A proper understanding of prophecy and the role that God has assigned to us is really important in understanding the priesthood of the believer. Now, before we discuss the third reason, it seems hot to me. Is it hot to you?
Yeah.
Now, our problem is that if we open that door back there, it's going to freeze out the back row. And if is there any other plan on that? Maybe if the last couple of the back rows could move forward here and we could leave that door open, then we could... Because it is kind of beastly hot. And we're going to want to spend a little time on this one also, because this is extremely important. When people's expectancy of the imminent return, the soon, quick, early return of the Lord, fades, a preoccupation with building institution results. Now, what I want to do is explain that, and then talk about it, and then explain it again at the end. Let me explain it this way. That if you believe that Jesus is going to return soon, then you haven't got time to build organizations and institutions. Then what you're trying to do is preach the gospel to every creature, lest they miss out on the great event. But if you don't believe that Jesus is coming soon, then you think, well, I got all the time in the world. And with all the time in the world, you began to build institutions. Now, this dawned on me for the first time when I was reading an article in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, understand, this is the Encyclopedia Britannica. This is not a theological dissertation. This is something that you might have in your own library. And if you've got the Encyclopedia Britannica, I invite you to look it up and read it. This is what it says. And I'm going to quote you here, all right? They're talking here about the evolution of the church from viewing Jesus coming quickly to sitting back and saying, he probably won't come for a long time, let's go ahead and build institutions. How did that happen? Here's what they say. Here's what the Encyclopedia Britannica says. Quote, "The spirit of philosophical and theological speculation, of ethical reflection, which began to spread through the churches in these early years, did not know what to make of the old hopes of the future that took place when the church just began. To this new generation, these hopes of the future seemed paltry, earthy, fantastic, and far-seeing men had good reason to regard them as a source of political danger. But more than this, these wild dreams about the glorious kingdom of Christ began to disturb the organization which the churches had seen fit to introduce. In the interests of self-preservation against the world, the state, and the heretics, the Christian communities had formed themselves into compact societies with a definite creed and constitution, and they felt that their existence was threatened by the white heat of religious subjectivity." You see, what happened is that the church began as an organism. It began as a band of brothers and sisters who loved one another and had a concern for a lost and dying world. And so that they went everywhere preaching the gospel, telling people about the good news, letting them know that Jesus was coming again and that they ought to be ready for this, that just on the other side of death there was judgment and that men and women ought to be prepared for that. But what happened was they evolved from an institution, or I should say from an organism, into an organization. And they became preoccupied with the building of the organization rather than with the individual. The organism was involved with the individual. The institution was involved with politics. And so instead of being concerned with the guy on the street, they were concerned with governments, legislation, controlling the state, and things like this. Let me use this illustration for you, see if we can bring it into focus. If you knew that you had 1 week to live, and at the end of 1 week, you'd be dead. This is what you know. You know that for sure. The doctor says to you, you can count on it. You've got 7 days. At the end of 7 days, you're a dead man or a dead woman. And you know that. You believe him? You know that to be true. I ask you, would you spend those last 7 days of your life building an addition on your house? I'd venture to say that most of us here probably wouldn't do that, would we? The only reason we build additions on our houses is because we believe we've got a lot of time. But if you believe your time is short, then you don't get involved in buildings. You get involved in the things that are really important. When the church lost its feeling that Jesus was going to come soon, it ceased being involved in the things that were important, i.e., the lives of people, and began to get involved in institutions. So that when it was thinking in terms of people, it used organizations or institutions to build men and women of God. But as it evolved, as it lost sight of the imminent return of the Lord, it began to use men and women of God to build institutions. Big difference between using an organization to build a man of God and using a man of God to build an organization. Big difference between those two. And that subtle shift takes place in all of our lives when we lose that sense of Jesus coming quickly. And one of the reasons it's important for us to study prophecy and understand what the Bible teaches on the subject is so that we can keep our minds uncluttered from secondary targets and locked in on the things that are truly important to the living God. If you've got 7 days to live, you're not going to build an addition on your house. You're going to give yourself to the things that are important. And prophecy teaches us that the days of our lives are numbered and that Jesus is coming soon. Now, any questions on this before we go on? Well, prophecy deals with this question of the future for Israel and how it relates to us as the church, the nation of Israel as opposed to the church. And when the church views itself as Israel and Israel is the church, then we lose our sense of mission because we revert back to the priesthood of the professional, which is so prevalent in the church today. And one of the things we're going to discover as we study prophecy is that Israel is not the church and the church is not Israel. They're two different things. Yes, Nancy.
Would you say with that that when you lose your vision of a priesthood believer, you also lose your sense of responsibility before the Lord?
Exactly. Yes. Jay, come on up here. We can clear this chair off.
There we go.
That's no problem. Yeah, Nancy, that's exactly right. Any other questions? I hope that you'll feel comfortable asking questions. There is no such thing as a dumb question or a wrong question. So if you have a question in your mind and you think, well, that's probably dumb, the chances are superb there are about 30 people in here that are thinking about the same question. So feel free to ask it.
Getting into more of what the priesthood of the believer is today, and did any of that at all alter?
No, I wasn't planning on doing that, no. Okay, feel free to interrupt and just break in on any questions that you have, because you don't have to worry about interrupting me or my losing my train of thought, because I don't know where I'm going anyway. We're just kind of... Now, the most important part of what I want to present this evening is what I would call the foundations of prophecy. Now, to introduce this, let me say to you that we all work with a set of assumptions. We assume certain things on a day-by-day basis in order to exist. We don't take time to enumerate them, most of them at least. We just kind of live our lives. For example, when you go off to work and you come home, you assume your wife's going to be there. You don't assume she's going to leave. When you go to work, you assume that the employer wants you back the next day. You don't think to yourself, well, let's see, I better check with him every single day as to whether or not I got a job the next day. You kind of assume that, unless he says otherwise. Yeah, that's right. When you go out in the automobile and you get in the car, you assume it's going to start. So you assume a lot of things in life. In the study of prophecy, there are three things we're going to assume. Now, an assumption is just simply a basis upon which we're going to operate that we're not going to take time to prove. Okay? We're going to operate on the basis of these three, but we're not going to try to prove that they're so. But everything else that we're going to talk about in our times together is predicated on the validity or the truth of these three things. So if you can't buy any one of these three, then that's going to make an appreciable difference in the conclusions that we come to in our prophetic study. Do you understand what we're saying here? These are the foundations. These are the assumptions here. Well, I can't prove to you these three, but we're going to assume them to be so. Now I want to discuss them with you. The first is interpretation. And there is a basic rule of interpretation that we're going to assume to be true. And that rule, or ground rule, or principle of interpretation is this: that a passage is to be interpreted literally unless the context demands otherwise. When you come to a passage in the Bible, you take it at face value unless the context demands that it be otherwise. Now let's illustrate it, all right? Somebody turn in their Bibles to Luke 13:32 and read that. Luke 13:32. Len, that's in the New Testament. Does she think I'm picking on you? She's right. But sis, you ought to see how he treats me. Who will read Luke 13:32 for us?
And he said to them, "Go and tell that fox, 'Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I finish my course.'"
Okay, now lock in on that. He said, Jesus is speaking, and he says, "Go, behold, go tell that fox, I do thus and so." Fox. F-O-X. Fox. Go tell that fox. Now, is he talking about a little four-leg, furry animal? Is that what he's saying there? All right. What is he saying? Who is the fox here? How do we know that? Because the verse above it tells us. So the context demands that we understand fox to mean Herod, not a fuzzy little four-legged creature. Does that make sense? The rule is this: that unless the context demands otherwise, we'll understand the Bible literally. Now, let me give you another illustration. Supposing a reporter for the Gazette or the Sun spent 3 months in Cambodia and comes back with this report of malnutrition, starvation, skin and bones, people dying, shriveled limbs, etc. And in graphic detail describes what he had seen for these 3 months in a series of articles in our local newspaper. And supposing after you read that, you came to him and said, "You know, as I read your article, I understood you to be saying that there is a great spiritual and intellectual thirst in Cambodia, and that the real problem over there is a lack of knowledge and a lack of understanding, and that really you've got to understand what you have written figuratively or metaphorically. That's right, thank you. My tongue got stuck in my teeth and I couldn't see there for a minute. And
yeah, hard word.
That is a hard word. Hard word, that's right. Now, what would the reporter say to you if you had read his article and interpreted it that way? Pardon? That's not what you meant at all. In other words, if we're going to go to what we read and do that with it, It makes it nonsensical. Whenever we pick up a newspaper, whenever we pick up a book, we take the words at their face value. We don't try to put some other meaning or significance into it. If it says it, we take that's what he means by it. We may not agree with it, but we take him at face value that that's what he meant by it. So also with the Bible. The writers of the Bible never meant for their writings to be understood in any other way than literally. Are we together? Now, that's one of our foundation stones. We're going to approach the study of the Bible literally, not figuratively, not spiritually, not allegorically. And we're going to take it for what it says. And we're going to assume that it means what it says, unless the context demands otherwise. Any questions on that? Like I say, if we can't buy that, then that'll make a huge difference in how we approach the whole subject of prophecy. That make sense? Okay, number two. The Abrahamic covenant. What I want us to do is turn to the book of Genesis. Okay, I'm going to give you a bunch of verses, and I'd like people to take those, if they would. Genesis 12:2. Who will take that? Okay, Len? Genesis 13:16. Who will take that? Okay, Don? Genesis 15:5. Who will take that? Okay. Genesis 17:4-5. Okay, Don? Okay. Genesis 12:3, who will take that? All right. Genesis 17:7. Okay. And then Jay, I'm going to let you go over to the book of Galatians and take Galatians 3:16. And then two more, Genesis 13:15, who will take that? Genesis 13:15, all right? And then one more, Genesis 17:8, okay? Now, through Abraham, God made some promises. Let's look at them. The first promise was that God would make through Abraham, or of Abraham, a great nation. Somebody read real loud now for us, Genesis 12:2. Okay, Genesis 13:16.
And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered.
Genesis 15:5.
He brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward heaven and tell the stars if thou be able to number them. And he said unto them, so shall thy seed be.
Genesis 17:4-5.
As for me, behold, my covenant is with you. And you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I will make you the father of a multitude of nations.
Okay. So the first thing we want to see is that he is going to make out of Abraham not only the father of a nation, but of a multitude of nations. That's the first part of the promise to Abraham. That's the first part of the Abrahamic covenant. Now the second part of the Abrahamic covenant that I want us to see is that salvation would come through the seed of Abraham. Somebody read Genesis 12:3.
I will bless those who bless you.
Genesis 17:7.
And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee in their generation for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee.
Okay. Now, keep that in mind as Jay reads for us Galatians 3:16.
Say to the offspring, referring to me, but referring to one
What he's saying here is that the promise to Abraham and to his offspring was the promise that through Abraham salvation would come in the person of Jesus Christ. That when it's said back there in Genesis 17:7, and by the word seed and offspring are synonyms. So he says, through your seed shall all the nations be blessed. Paul says in Galatians 3:16, he didn't say seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Jesus Christ. So, the second part of the Abrahamic covenant was that through Abraham, salvation would come to the people of the earth. Then the third part is that God would give to Abraham and his descendants the land as an eternal possession. Genesis 13:15.
For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever.
Forever, I'll give it to you. Okay? And then again, in 17:8.
And I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for the everlasting possession.
See, I'll give you that land as an everlasting possession. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's the reason we've got problems in the Middle East today. Because the Arabs and the Jews don't see eye to eye regarding those promises. And Biggin is an Orthodox Jew who says that all those promises given back there in the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, those promises are true for us. God gave them to us as an everlasting possession, and we're here just reclaiming that which was given to us originally. And it didn't go over so well with the Arabs. And to be honest with you, that, apart from the intervention of God, is an unsolvable problem. That is an unsolvable problem. But the second foundation stone for our study of prophecy is the Abrahamic covenant. To understand that the Abrahamic covenant had three major parts to it. Number one, that out of Abraham, God would bless the nations of the world. He would make of Abraham multitude of nations. Number two, that through Abraham, salvation would come to the world. And number three, to Abraham and his descendants, God would give the land for an eternal or everlasting possession. Any questions on that? Okay, the third foundation has to do with the character of God. Now, I'd like to suggest to you this evening that our relationship with God is not dependent upon our performance, but dependent rather upon God's performance on our behalf. Let me repeat that. Our relationship with God is not dependent upon our performance, but rather it is dependent upon God's performance on our behalf. We don't go to heaven because of what we do. We go to heaven because of what Jesus did for us. Now, that has to do with the character of God. The word we use to describe that is grace. It is the grace of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. Now, somebody read again some more verses for us here. Genesis 12:17. Who will take that? Okay, Len? Genesis 15:6. Who will take that? Okay? And then Genesis 17:1-8. Who will take that? Thanks, Don. Okay. Genesis 12:17.
But the Lord struck Pharaoh.
No. That's Exodus.
Genesis.
He's right.
That's Old Testament, Warner.
12:17?
Yes, sir, Lord. This is the authorized version, too.
Mercy. Len, read on, but I think I made a mistake.
Okay. It says, Mike says, but the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife.
I blew it.
What is it, Exodus 12?
No. No, it was Genesis 12, but I don't have the right verse there, Len. How could I have done that? You know, I want you to understand this is... Yeah, that sounds better. Yeah, I want you to understand, though, this is only the second time in my life I've ever made a mistake. The first time I made a mistake was when I thought I was wrong and really wasn't. Yeah, why don't you read 12:7 for us?
And the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. So he built an altar there, the Lord, and it appeared to him.
Okay, now in all of these passages, I want you to notice that there's no if. Now the little word if, I-F, connotes condition. If you do this, then I'll do this. That's condition. The absence of the word if means it's without condition. It's not dependent upon what we're going to do. It's dependent upon what God's going to do. I say to you, if you do this, then I'll do that. That's conditional. If I say to you, I'm going to do this for you, no conditions. That's a whole different ballgame, isn't it? I say to you, I'll give you $50. What do I have to do for it? Nothing. I'll just give it to you. I say to you, if you work 5 hours for me, then I'll give you $50. Difference between those two. And in these passages, I want you to notice that there's no if. God is going to do it without condition. Yes?
What one condition? Abraham had to get out of that country. Go back to the beginning of it. It says, now the Lord said to Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and so forth. So that was conditional upon Abraham's response to God's.
Now, the absence of the if does not mean that God does not give any commands. But there's nowhere in these passages that you will understand that the fulfillment of the promise was based upon the obedience to the command. He does not say in this passage, or in any of these passages, I'm not going to do this if you don't get out of the land. Now, many times God tells Abraham to do things. Go do this, go do that, don't do this, do this. But the if word is missing. And that's the point I want you to note. The absence of the if doesn't mean that there are no commands. It just means that the blessings aren't conditioned upon the obedience of the commands. Okay, the 15 passage, which is one of the famous passages in all the Bible, quoted often in the New Testament.
Then he believed in the Lord, and the Lord reckoned him to him as righteous.
Yes. Solely on the basis of his belief that God would do what he said, not on the basis of Abraham's performance. And then finally, the Genesis 17 passage. That's the one you got, Don.
That's the one I got.
I appreciate you doing that, by the way.
And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me, and be thou perfect. And I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be the father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham. And for a father of many nations have I made thee. And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee, and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee, and to thy seed after thee, the land wherein thou art a stranger, all of the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God.
Okay. Now, grace simply means what God does to us in spite of us, not because of us. Grace is God giving us what we don't deserve. And that's why the Bible calls Abraham the father of the faithful. That's why the Jews said to John the Baptist, "We have Abraham for our father." They all understood that. Now, let me point out to you that as a believer, those of us sitting in this room tonight who own Jesus as our Lord and Savior, when we sin, not if we sin, but when we sin, that does not destroy our relationship with God. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to pay for our sin. Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. What a man sows, that shall he also reap." And as believers, when we sin, we reap what we sow. But that doesn't affect our relationship with God. The illustration I like to use on that is, let's say for a second that in a moment of discouragement, I decide that I'm going to commit suicide. I'm going to end the whole thing. And so I get up on top of the Holly Sugar building, and I say I'm going to jump down into the plaza below. And so I stand there on the edge, and I jump off. And on the way down, I think to myself, you know, Henderson, this has got to be one of the dumbest things you've ever done. And I say, you know, God, would you forgive me? And God says, Henderson, count it done. Forgiven. Never bring up the subject again. As a matter of fact, your sin is separated from you as far as east is from west. You've got 3 floors to go. That's what you call the law of the harvest. You reap what you sow. Didn't affect my relationship with God, but it sure affected me. Now, that's true in all of our lives. And we've got to make a distinction between reaping what we sow in terms of our conduct and the grace of God. Because, you see, our sins do not break our relationship with God, but they can sure break us. We are eternally secure in the Lord simply because our relationship with God was not based upon our performance, but upon His. It had nothing to do with what we do. It has to do with what He does. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. "For by grace are ye saved, through faith, and not of yourselves." It's the gift of God. Not of works, lest any man should boast. Now, just as that's true for us today, so it was true for Israel back in those early days. So it's true for Israel as a nation. Now, Israel's sins did not jeopardize the promises that God had made to them through Abraham unconditionally, but it sure did affect the blessing in their lives. And they were beat around the ears, and they were sent into captivity, and they had all kinds of problems because of their sins. But always God comes back to them and says, "Yet, nevertheless, you are my people." Now, what I want to do is take a look at a passage with you. Turn with me to the book of Amos, chapter 9. Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah. Whew, had a list right here. No, not really. Amos chapter 9, we got it? Len, that's in the Old Testament.
Page 1277.
Almost. Okay, now in Amos chapter 9, pardon? It's really in there.
Yeah, it is.
Now, this is just simply illustrative of the thing I want you to notice in the Bible. You'll see this again and again in the book of Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and many other passages. In Amos, he's talking about how God punishes Israel because of their sins. And I'm not going to take time to read all of these verses, but I'll pick it up at verse 8. He says, "Behold, the eyes of the Lord God are upon the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from off the face of the earth, saving that I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob, saith the Lord. For lo, I will command, and I will sift the house of Israel among all the nations, like as corn is sifted in a sieve, yet shall not the least grain fall upon the earth. All the sinners of my people shall die by the sword, which say, the evil shall not overtake, nor prevent us. In that day I will raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old. And they that possess the remnant of Edom, and of all the heathen which are called by my name, saith the Lord that doth this. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed, and the mountains shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. And I will bring again the captivity of my people of Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof, and they shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them, and I will plant them upon the land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of their land which I have given them, saith the Lord thy God." And all these passages in the Bible where God says, "I will chastise them, I will send my rod of affliction upon them, I will scatter them in dispersion, I will do this and this to them, nevertheless, they are my people. And in the latter days I will bring them again and restore them. I will put a new heart in them and a new spirit in them. And they will be my people and I will be their God." Now, the point I want you to notice here is that the character of God is such that when he makes an unconditional promise to his people, he never rescinds it. He never reneges. And just as it's true for us as individuals, so it was true for the nation of Israel. Now, as individuals who know Jesus and are saved, when we sin, we pay through the nose for it. So Israel as a nation, when it sinned, paid through the nose for it. But just as Christians today, that does not affect our eternal security with God, so also for Israel, it never affected their eternal relationship with God. God says, "You are my people." Now, as we study prophecy, and this study progresses, we're going to see that God's future plans for Israel play an important part. Again and again, the Old Testament prophets predict the very thing that we read here in Amos. Let me just have you read a couple of other passages. Somebody will take Isaiah 11, 1 through 11. Who will read that for us? Ah, oh, thank you, Don. And then Zechariah 8, 20 through 23. You going to do it, Jay? Thank you. Zechariah 8, 20 through 23. Now, Zechariah is almost at the end of the Old Testament. If you find Malachi, just turn left. Okay, Isaiah 11.
"The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib. But Israel doth not know, my people doth not consider. A sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, the seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord, they have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backward. Why should ye be stricken any more? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises, and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your presence. And it is desolate, is overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is left as a cottage in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city. Except the Lord of hosts has left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah. Hear ye the word of the Lord, ye rulers of Sodom, give ear unto the law of our God. Ye people of Gomorrah, to what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me? Saith the Lord, I am full of the burnt offerings of rams, and the fat of fed beasts, and I delight not in the blood of bullocks, or of lambs, or of he goats.
Okay. Is that chapter 11?
That's chapter 1.
That's what I thought. Well, you know, I thought to myself, you know, I thought as I was reading that, I thought to myself, you know, that sounds like chapter 1. And I thought, well, you know, I could have been wrong on that. It's 11, 1 through 11.
You want to try that again now?
Chapter 1, or 1 through 11. And the second reading shall be.
Did I say chapter 1?
No.
Maybe it was my fault.
I just did.
Okay, chapter 11.
And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he shall make... Is that right, Wayne?
That's it. I'm following along this time. That's really good.
And shall make him of quick understanding and the fear of the Lord. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. And the righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion, and the fatling together, and the little child shall leap, and the cow and the bear shall feed.
The wolf does not lie down with the lamb, and so forth. God has not gathered his people a second time and brought them into the land. This is something that is yet future. And then let me just check my notes on that, Jay. Zechariah. You're going to be reading Zechariah 8, 20 through 23. Yeah. Promise again that is yet to be fulfilled. But it has a promise dealing with the future of Israel. Now, in closing this off, let me just give you an overview of Romans chapter 9 through 11. Now, I did not have one of these overviews made, and that was an oversight on my part, and I'll have one of these for you next time, all right? So you don't have to worry about copying this down. But chapter 9 deals with the whole subject of God selecting. In chapter 10, deals with the fact that the Jews were rejected. They were faithless. They were cast off. Chapter 11 deals with the fact of the Jews' restoration or acceptance. He uses in chapter 11 the illustration of an olive tree. He says, now what's happened is that Israel is an olive tree. And what God has done is he's taken the natural branch, the nation of Israel, and he's cut it off and set it aside. And what he's done is he's grafted a wild branch into it. That's the Gentiles. But Paul says, don't misunderstand that. Because that doesn't mean that God is through with the Jews. Because God is someday going to take that natural branch and regraft it back in again so that it also grows. And what I want us to do is take a look at just a couple of verses out of Romans chapter 11 where Paul highlights this. Somebody read verses 25 through 32. Who will take Romans 11, 25 to 32? This will be the last passage for this evening we'll read. Okay, Don, real loud if you would.
For I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery, lest you be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and thus all Israel will be saved, just as it is written, the Deliverer will come from Zion, he will remove ungodliness from Jacob, and this is my covenant with them, when I take away their sins. From the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers.
Through 32.
And the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. For just as you once were disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, so these also now have been disobedient, in order that because of the mercy shown to you, they also may not be shown mercy. For God has shut up all in disobedience, that he might show mercy to all.
Okay, and here Paul says, categorically, that God has a future for the nation of Israel. Now, historically, I want you to look at it with me for a moment. Israel as a nation, because of their sins, went into captivity in the year 586 B.C., 586 years before Christ. At that moment, Israel ceased to exist as a nation. That was when Nebuchadnezzar came in, destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and took Israel into captivity into Babylon. 70 years later, Israel returned. But at that time, they never had their freedom. They were always under the rulership of somebody else. First under Cyrus, then under Darius, and then later on under Alexander the Great, you know, Alexander the Great, who conquered them. And then when he died, it was divided up, and then he was under Syria, and then he was under Egypt, and then he was under Rome, and then the Romans destroyed them and scattered them all over the world. In 1948, they came back again into Israel. Under United Nations Charter, they were given their land. But again, it was not really wholly theirs, for they were never able to reinstitute the sacrificial order. For sitting at the site of the temple, the only place they could sacrifice was a mosque, which again is one of the points of conflict. So Israel, from 586 BC until the present, has never been able to function as an entire entity. For 2,500 years, Israel has not been able to function as God had promised her she would. 70 years of captivity, they came back, they had religious freedom, but not political freedom. For 2,000 years, they were scattered across the face of the earth. In 1948, they came back again. They had political freedom, but not religious freedom. And from the time of the Babylonian captivity to the present, Israel has never been able to fulfill its role, God-given rule, in the Old Testament scriptures. And all the promises of God from that moment, from 586 B.C. on up to the present, have pointed to the time when God would restore it all and bring it back again. And that's what Paul's talking about here in Romans 9 through 11. So the promises of the Old Testament prophets are yet to be fulfilled. Now, what exactly is the fulfillment to look like? And that's what we'll pick it up from next time. Any questions before we adjourn? That is correct. Oh, they can't sacrifice. They would institute the sacrificial order or the snap of the finger if they could. They can't. The offering of lambs and bulls and goats and all of these other things that they had in the Old Testament.
Can they
time determine who the their professional priest would be? I mean, the order of Levi and Aaron and all that, can they identify those people?
I don't know, Don. That's a good question, but I just don't know whether they've lost track of that or not.
But that could also be a hindrance.
Yes. Yeah. How accurate their records are, I do not know.
So that plus the fact that their place is they can't get to their place where they need to make the sacrifice.
Yeah, that's the
number. Stops them from having religious freedom.
Right, that's the number one hindrance is they can't reestablish the sacrificial system because God says it's got to be done at a particular place.
And they can't get there.
And they can't get there. The mosque is sitting on it.
And where?
That's on the. Have you ever seen a picture inside of Jerusalem of the dome of the mosque? It's a big gold dome, beautiful building sitting there. That's it. That's the site of the temple called Mount Moriah. That's the place that Abraham offered Isaac. That's the place where David brought the tabernacle. And that's where Solomon built the temple.
It's there.
Yeah. Oh, and send them into heaven on a horse. That's exactly right. Tremendous significance to them. Which makes that, again, an unsolvable problem. I mean, the United Nations aren't going to be able to handle that.
Or anything else. Could they just kind of get a crane and pull up the mosque?
They could have joint services.
And the Holy of Holies.
Yeah. Yes.
I think I've heard it argued that Gentile believers can't claim these promises because they were the main nation of Israel. Is there a line of theology that promotes that? And wouldn't the answer be that our Romans were grafted in, were all part of that promise?
Yeah, there's a difference between interpretation and application. It's one thing to interpret a passage and understand what its meaning is and its significance and its fulfillment, etc. It's another thing for the Spirit of God to say, okay, I want you to apply it to your own life. So I would say that all of the promises of God are applicable for us. But in applying them to us, that does not negate them for Israel. See, for example, when you read the book of Acts, chapter 13, Paul says, God called me to work with the Gentiles. And the verse that he quotes to prove that God called him was a promise that the Old Testament had given to the Messiah. Well, when Paul claimed that for his own life, that didn't mean that wasn't a messianic promise. So I think if Paul were talking, he'd say, well, yeah, I understand that. I interpret it correctly. That's a messianic promise. But the Spirit of God gave it to me to apply. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, are we just spiritualizing when we apply it, or is the promise actually going to be to all believers, even though they were made to Israel?
Well, the promises made to Israel are only for Israel. The promises made to us are only for us. But those promises can be applied for all people everywhere. The application and fulfillment are different. See, God can use any verse in the Bible he wants to lead you and to get you to do his will.
Well, when David makes a promise to quote his people, we can apply that to us.
Oh, yeah, can and should. But the application of it is different than the interpretation of it. Oh, let's take a look at one of those verses. Let's look at Acts chapter 13. It's as good of an illustration as comes to my mind right now. Why don't you read for me Acts 13:47. Well, actually, read verses 46 and 47 both.
Then Paul and Barnabas answered him boldly. He had to speak the word of God to you first, since
Gentiles. For this is what the Lord has commanded us. I have made you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring salvation to the ends of the earth.
Okay, now this is a quote out of Isaiah 42. And when you read Isaiah 42, this verse that Paul is quoting, that's messianic. That deals with the Messiah. So, I'm very confident, although Paul doesn't say that right here, I'm very confident Paul understood that. That was a messianic promise. But Paul says, even though that was a messianic promise fulfilled by the Messiah, God, the Holy Spirit, used it to tell me that he wants me to minister to the Gentiles.
So a literal interpretation that literally it was applied to Christ, but application-wise, Paul used it to guide his own life.
Correct. And what's the very thing we ought to do through all of the Bible? God may speak to Abraham. And we understand that he's not speaking to us, he's speaking to Abraham, but we can apply it. See, Paul speaks to Timothy. He says, you know, don't trust uncertain riches. Well, we can apply that. Even though we understand that he was writing to Timothy. And so it is through all the Bible.
I have a question. Some people, back on your subject matter of jumping off the Holly building, you were saying, you know, the law of the harvest. A lot of people say that God's in control of everything and that he would not allow anything to happen. But doesn't God's promises apply only when we're in fellowship with him? When we're out of fellowship, when we left our own resources, can we not bring havoc onto ourselves? Or does God allow that to happen to us?
Yeah, the Bible teaches that, first of all, nobody can touch God's people except by his permission. But the Bible also teaches that you can destroy your own life. Jumped off the Holly Sugar building. Sure could have. And the Bible is full of men who did just that.
So we really can't say that God's letting this happen to us. We're bringing it upon ourselves.
Yeah.
We also have a problem with chastisement.
Yes. Yeah. That's important. And it's also important, and we don't want to get into this in great depth, but to make a distinction between chastisement and punishment. See, the rebuke of the Lord is never punitive. It's always corrective. And so that's right. There are times, you know, when he asks us to grab a hold of our ankles and he applies...
feet of our pants.
Yeah. But that is his spanking. That is his chastisement, but never punishment. See, punishment for our sins has been taken care of on the cross. God will never punish us again for our sins. Spank us, yes. Punish us, never.
There's conditions for answered prayer.
Yep, sure are. Yeah, unconditional salvation does not mean that there are not conditions for other things. There sure are. Well, I think that I have... gone long enough. I think you're about as tired as you look.